This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. So excited for today's guest. Back always by popular demand, we've got Professor of Finance at the Beattie School of Business, Andre Pavlov. What an absolute force. This conversation is one of my favorites of the year, I think. And just great having Andre back on the show.
You know, one thing I've been thinking about since we've had this conversation is Andre's argument that I think is a really interesting one. You know, it's not necessarily interest rates. It's not Trump tariff policies. It's our own government's policies that have not only destroyed the value of real estate, but made it a risky investment, right? And yeah, that's why the money is not coming back. And that's why investors are not coming back. You know, no one's put it as plainly as Andre and as clearly and as succinctly. So great conversation with him today.
We cover policy. We cover the current state of the market, where the market's going. We talk about the Cowichan decision. We talk about interest rates.
We even talk about the AI boom.
We talk about the AI boom. We talk about the Canadian budget, the federal budget. We talk about so many things today, but we kept them for, I think, an hour, just over an hour, but it is a riveting conversation. But before we get to that, Matt, of course, we have the segment that remains nameless.
Well, wait a second, Adam. I was going to say, before we get to that, you needed a ride to work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I am sans car. This was a situation that happened the other night. I told you the brief. I'll keep it brief. But essentially, I parked on the street in front of my house, something I usually don't do. I usually park in the garage. I was in a hurry. I parked out front. I totally forgot I parked on the street. I'm on Union bike route. So bike fairly road, high yeah. traffic for like bikes and multimodal transportation, Matt. Anyways, I wake up the next day. I go down. I see my car is got parts of my car sitting on, like somebody has placed it on the hood. Anyways, I got the driver's side.
Hold on. You showed me a photo just to be clear. It looks like somebody,
like a bus hit the side of my car.
Yeah. Or like somebody took a baseball bat to your mirror. Like it's not even like, oh, it's knocked off. It's like in smithers. Like it's just, it's like wires. Yeah. Hanging off of
that's exactly
your car,
it.
Like it's been destroyed.
It's like a few wires dangling. The mirror's totally smashed off, and then there's the dent. There's scratches. So, you know, first thing I do is I call ICBC, and they're like, "Well, what happened?" And I'm like, "For sure, it got hit by a car. Like it's just like there's nothing like would have that yeah. impact." And I was thinking, "Oh, well, you know, there's nobody left a note. Nothing was left behind." I'm thinking somebody, it happened probably in the middle of the night. It was a Friday night. Guessing somebody was maybe, I don't know, was it a drunk driver perhaps?
Inebriated.
They kept going. They didn't leave a note. Anyways, I remember I've got cameras on my house. I didn't think I would capture it. But surprisingly, my car was parked in the perfect place on the street where the front camera gets like a pretty good view. And now I've got to go over like 18 hours of footage and I don't have it because I don't have it like, you know, a lot of people would get the alerts when there's activity. I can't because there's enough activity on Union that it would just, you know, there would be an alert all the time. So anyways, I have to like sift through this. So I spent like probably 3 hours doing it. I'm just kind of moving up every 15 seconds or so. And finally,
but ICBC wanted.
They did. Yeah. Yeah. They said, just double check your cameras just so if you can get any information. So around 3:27 a.m., out of nowhere.
Around 3:27. Yeah, yeah.
And change. Out of nowhere, a Lime scooter collides with the side of my car. And you see a full-grown male, like probably 6 feet, 200 pounds.
45.
Yeah, probably 45. Fly through the air like as if you threw a stuffed animal. Like it's just like he's cartwheeling through the air.
It looked almost like the footage. Like it looked like the Tasmanian devil or something.
Crazy.
Like.
It was crazy. The craziest wipeout.
It's so fast. He was going as fast as you possibly could.
On the wrong side of the road.
There's no question about that.
Yeah, and definitely inebriated. The best part about it is not only was it a hit and run, but he stands there and he looks. I've got all the footage and I'm sending it in, but he looks at the damage of the car. And I guess
it will be a Vancouver real.
Yeah, we should post the video. We should. It's such a crazy video. It would go viral if I posted it to social media, but I'm not going to do that. But anyways, he walks over and then a bystander, like somebody like Good Samaritan comes over to make sure he's okay. This again is 3:27 in the morning.
Like a guy presumably biking by
or something. So the guy, I think it was maybe a cab driver, I'm not sure, but comes over and makes sure the guy is okay. And anyways, they are both standing there and he does leave a note. And so as I'm watching this, I'm like, oh, how did I miss the note? Anyways, go back to the video. 15 minutes after when the Good Samaritan has left the scene, you see this same guy.
The not so Good Samaritan shows up again.
The guy who flew through the air, cartwheeled through the air, come back and steal the note that he left me off of my car and then head east down Union. It's unbelievable. Anyways, yeah, so I don't have a car here for 2 weeks.
Here's the thing though, that you pointed out, and this is the problem with using
Lime scooters,
but bike shares, all sorts of sharing products. Not only do they know who this guy is, they know when it fell.
They can
chart when he crashed.
They told me they know
where he went after.
Exactly when the scooter was down. Like when a scooter goes down, it often says to you, it's like, did you fall or does like, because actually I've had a friend of mine who had an accident on a Lime scooter and she said the first thing it did was like, did you just have an accident? You need to report the accident, like this big thing. Yeah. But yeah, no, they have like the coordinates and everything. So it's like for sure. And they cooperate
He's done.
Well, you know, he's probably not done. He's probably paying maybe a $500 deductible, but not yet.
No, this is long-term jail sentence.
Good situation.
A lot of takeaways.
But I don't have a car. But Matt, we have the segment that remains nameless.
Yes, we do. Here's the quiz question this week. This made headlines about a week ago. I thought I'd revisit and actually look at the report, see if I can stump you. So there was a happiness index ranking that came out, I believe a couple weeks ago, and then Zillow or one of these, somebody linked it to housing prices. So like, what's the cost of happiness in various cities? That was the headline. I actually just went back to the happiness index ranking to come up with a quiz question. So the top 10 largest cities in Canada were ranked, Adam. And here's the question. According to the 2025 average happiness index, where does Vancouver rank among Canada's 10 largest cities?
I'm
going to give you four options. Wasn't number one. That was Mississauga.
Really?
Of all places. Yeah.
That seems crazy.
Was it A, 5th place? B, 6th place? C, 8th place? Or D, 10th place? So we know it did not crack the top 5 happiest places in Canada.
Okay. Well, Matt, I'm going to...
Before we get to that, Adam, let's talk about one of our new listings. You know what? We've talked about a couple solds over the last few weeks. Let's talk about a new listing. This hit the market on Monday in the Heights.
Oh, I love the Heights.
In North Burnaby, right along Hastings. You know what I love about this listing? We're launching it right near the holiday season. And let me ask you this, Adam. Is there a better place to be than North Burnaby along Hastings around Christmas time?
They do a way better job of Vancouver. It's like jarring when you're driving down Hastings in Burnaby. The kids are like, this is magical. This is beautiful. And then you cross boundary and immediately you're like, oh no, this is Hastings. It's not magical. There's nothing magical about it.
Actually, you know what? It's funny. I'm not sure. Everybody should take a note from the Heights, and presumably it's the business community, or I don't know. It's one of the nicest spots over the holidays in Metro Vancouver that I know of. So Adam, this is a listing in the Heights, 410-4310 Hastings Street, one bedroom, one bath, stunning mountain views. It has it all, parking, storage, outdoor space, beautiful home at Union by Mosaic Homes, boutique building, but concrete. Very rarely can you say that. It's only five stories. Fantastic amenity, outdoor space with a fire pit and views for days. It's offered at $549,900 over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And while you're there, Adam, click Sell With Us, where you can download the sold plan, that start on launch date, the guide to get your home sold fast and for top dollar. And that's, of course, at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. But let's get back to this this quiz question, because I think you kind of thought we were going to be a top four spot, but that's not the case.
No, my initial guess was I was going to say seventh, but I think the closest thing is maybe I'll say eighth. I think eighth was one of your options.
Yeah, we had sixth and eighth. Now walk me through the process.
I feel like we're always ranking really poorly on these lists right now. I'm surprised Mississauga. I would imagine Calgary is up there quite high.
Calgary's up there quite high. You're right.
Top five. I know. I feel like these, some real BS going on out there. It's always like, I mean, come on, tour Canada, come to Vancouver, you know, and have a look. But there's just no way.
The index does not lie, Adam. We were ranked eighth out of 10 cities.
Oh, were we really?
And you know, man. So you got it right. Here's the other thing. We were very on a price per happiness. We were, of course, the most expensive. But here's a curious part about the price per happiness ranking. So coming in just behind Vancouver, you'll be interested.
Manitoba.
Was Winnipeg. Winnipeg was number nine out of the top 10. But guess what? Right. On a price per happiness, Winnipeg was the top city in the country.
It's pretty affordable happiness over there, though.
It's a pretty affordable place to be happy, even though it's one of the lowest ranked in terms of happiness in general. But let's cut to our talk with Andrei Pavlov here. I feel like we've kind of burying the lead, because this one is a fantastic conversation.
Yeah, enjoy.
Attention realtors, homebuyers, and investors. If you missed out on Atlin at Clayton Crest by Zentera Developments, here's your second chance.
Atlin sold 80% in just 3 months, Adam. And because of that success, Zentera is launching Building 2, Butte.
Located in West Clayton and walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, prices are still low for now, but not for long.
Homeowners across the Lower Mainland are using equity from their current homes to invest in West Clayton, ahead of the SkyTrain and the next market upswing. Because when that SkyTrain is complete and the market rebounds, it'll be too late.
This, Matt, is how wealth is built. Find out why Atlin sold so fast and register now at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown. And we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia,
serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakland, please reach out to us at oakland.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
Okay, so we're here with Professor Andrei Pavlov. He is a professor of finance at Beattie School of Business at SFU. And of course, past guest fan favorite. Thanks so much for coming back, Andrei. Great to see you.
Of course, thank you for having me.
Can we maybe start by telling some of our listeners who maybe aren't familiar with you a little bit about yourself?
Well, I've been doing real estate research for a while. I got a PhD from UCLA in real estate finance, you know, about 2 decades ago. And then I landed in Vancouver somehow. And of course, Vancouver, main topic of conversation here is real estate pretty much everywhere. So it's like, it was a bit lucky that I landed here and I can do interesting work. And then after a while, I kind of figured out that I have opinions and observations that are different from what the general media and many people think. So I like to share those, hopefully change some minds down the road.
I've noticed, I was just in anticipation of this conversation, I was just looking at some recent papers you have written, and a lot of them seem to be with Tom Davidoff and Sir Somerville. The three of you still quite, because there was some, you were at odds on a lot of things.
Absolutely.
In previous years. Yeah, like why collaborate with those two, and what's the value of working on papers together?
So I bring that relationship as an example of how we disagree on many issues. We agree on a lot of issues, actually. If you listen to us carefully, we agree on a lot more than we disagree on. But regardless, there are certain things like the speculation vacancy tax and other local measures that we disagree on. But that's the beauty of it, that in no way affects our personal relationship. So both Tom and Tsur are fantastic friends. We hang out. I'm always happy to have coffee with them. And I think that's how the conversation needs to be. And the only reason that happens, I think, other than they're pretty bright and nice people, the main reason is that we are all interested in figuring out something useful, something that we're figuring out. I don't want to say the truth, because truth is always relative, but at least figuring out something useful that can then lead to, a better province and a better country. And if I happen to say something that later I discover is wrong, often because Tom or Zur say something, that's no problem, right? I have no problem saying things that eventually turn out to be wrong, as long as that furthers the goal of improving our understanding of the housing market and kind of making life better for British Columbians and Canadians in general. So that's the key. As long as you're focused in scientific discussions and scientific research, as long as you're focused on figuring out the ultimate goal, then disagreements are very natural. And in fact, it'd be very weird if we don't have disagreements. And that in no way affects our personal relationship. If anything, it makes it stronger, because we have something to talk about rather than just the weather.
Right. Healthy disagreements. Andre, maybe to open up the conversation, is Vancouver real estate in a healthier place today than it was 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago in your mind?
No, it's a complete disaster in my view. I think the very misguided policies that we've implemented, like I already mentioned, the speculation and vacancy tax, but it's not just that. It's the Airbnb ban and the foreign ownership registry or whatever, the corporate ownership registry, land ownership registry, whatever it is, all of these things. There's probably more than one of those. All these things sound good on paper, and they were sold as measures to improve affordability because we want to, so for example, the empty home taxes and the speculation vacancy tax was sold as a measure to help people occupy units that are currently empty. So kind of like on the surface, who can argue with that, right? We would be making more efficient use of the housing that we already have. So it's great on paper, except every time we introduce something like that, we increase the risk and the cost of building more housing. So what we gain in, the small gains that we have in more efficiently using the real estate that we do have, all of that is lost and a lot more in making it harder, riskier, and more expensive to build more. And as a result, our chronic shortages continue. And they're no better today than they were at any time in the past. Now, people will quote things like, well, prices are down and rents are down and things like that. Yeah, but the question is, are we housing more people? And, sales volume is still well below the 10-year average. It has recovered the last couple of months. So it's approaching the 10-year average, but it's still, last time I looked, it was below, which means fewer people are finding homes. Now, it's interesting that we have inventory and you can actually buy a home if you want to. But no one can afford it really. And even if you can afford it, many people are probably taking a pause because of layer upon layer of risk that we have introduced and made housing less affordable. So, I mean, less attractive. So cheaper is not necessarily more affordable. Cheaper is great as long as it's the same product. If we've made the product worse, and we have, then the fact that it's cheaper, it's like paying half price for an apple that's spoiled, right? No one wants it anyway. It doesn't matter how cheap it is. It goes, because you can't eat it. So that we've destroyed the value in our real estate. And in doing so, we're building less, we're housing fewer people, and we're hurting the economy in the process.
And I feel like there's a couple places to go there. Can you just unpack or make it as clear as possible what you mean by destroying the value? Like it's policy that has destroyed the value of Vancouver real estate.
Well, there's speculation and vacancy tax, right? So it says there are certain things you used to be able to do with your home and now you can't. So it's an infringement on property rights, but your home is now worth, as in not worth monetarily to you, it's worth less because now you're more limited in what you can do with it. And even if you're currently occupying your home and you know, the declaration takes 5 minutes to do and it's no big deal, even then, you understand that life is unpredictable. And at some point in the future, you might have to leave your home empty. You might have to move to another city. And when you move, you're not going to sell right away. There's all kinds of circumstances that can change that, you know, immediate occupancy status. And then you're in really pretty big trouble. You face mountains of paperwork and pretty high taxes at the end if you can't meet the precise thresholds set by administrators and politicians who, you know, probably have never been through that kind of change. So that's one example where, sure, it's exactly the same home, but your ability to use it in the way you want has been decreased, and therefore it's worth less. So it's like taking one room from your home and saying you can't use it, right? We'll lock it up and you can't use it anymore. It needs to stay empty. So you understand if we do that, that's going to reduce the value of real estate, right? Because now you have, instead of two bedrooms, you now have one bedroom, right? Okay. So it's going to reduce the value of the real estate, but doesn't make it more affordable. It just makes it worse, and a lower price would, it's not because there's more on the market and you can live better. It's because you now have less.
Oh, that's an interesting take.
And have we seen, if I understand correctly, so you're saying that policies that we've created in this market have devalued real estate as an asset here in BC, and have prices come down to offset that devaluation in your mind?
Yeah, so I think it's pretty clear that the government policies slow decrease, you know, meltdown of home prices. And I don't know if that's the actual motivation, but that's the outcome of all the policies. And this is an entirely predictable outcome. I think that's not a surprise to anyone. So then the question is, have prices come down far enough? And the answer to that is no. Absolutely not. And the reason is we're building, you know, less and less and not enough. So I recently looked up some data like this. We completed fewer housing units in Metro Vancouver in 2024 relative to 2018. So forget about population growth, forget about economic growth. We actually completed fewer, not more, fewer, not even flat. Now, 2025, I think, started pretty strong. But from what I gather, the last data is that actually many projects are, you know, put on hold or straight out abandoned. And then we see the housing starts taking a real dive in 2025. So we're just not supplying enough. And by not supplying enough, we are pushing prices higher than what they would be if there was sufficient supply. And we still had those policies that really kind of undermine the property rights of home ownership.
Andre, can we talk a little bit about rental? Because with CMHC financing over the last couple of years, a lot of developers have pivoted to rental. You know, some of those projects that you mentioned that have been paused or put on hold, or deposits have been returned, or you know, going to receivership, all these things that are happening. A lot of those projects are actually being turned into purpose-built rental, right? So there's a lot of rental currently being built. There's a lot of rental that's hit the market in the last year. I'm wondering your take on how that impacts the market long-term, because there's housing units being built, but they're not for sale. So what do you think the long-term impact of that is on the real estate market?
So that's obviously welcome news that we're building more rental. So for years, I think for over a decade, we've had vacancy rate in Vancouver below 1%. So to see that tick up, I think it's now at 1.2 or something like that. That's obviously good. We need 3%. So normal market needs 3% vacancy to operate, you know, just purely, you know, from having inventory to offer customers when they walk in the door. So we're not anywhere near that level at all. But, you know, a slight increase in vacancy is obviously very welcome. The problem I see is that many of those rental completions, the new units, were not started as rentals. They were started as something else. They were started as condos or whatever other type of property. And then they were converted to rentals because that was kind of like the market situation. But that the reason that's a problem is that next time those projects will not get started at all. So it's one thing it's not so great to convert midstream into something that's sort of like the lesser evil. And we know it's the lesser evil because if, you know, the original goal was still feasible, you would have continued to that. It's costly to switch. So that's not a way to build to sustainably build sufficient supply in the market by kind of, you know, forcing people to switch from one property type to another that only offers temporary relief. So yeah, sure, rents are down now, but will not last. It will not last past these few projects that have been converted. Once they come online and get absorbed, I think we're not going to get very much of that. Because now to start a rental project, you have to face the fact that, you know, the rents are not rising quite as fast as they used to. So you're not going to start that project until you see rents returning back to previous quick rent increases.
Andre, I'm just thinking about, so we talked a little bit before we push record here about how the market sales volume in the market for a long time now has been below the 10-year average, somewhere between, call it 10 to 20% below the 10-year average. Do you see this as part of a market cycle, or what do you think is driving the softness of this current market? Can you talk about kind of the major factors?
Well, I think the major factor is government intervention. So we have put policies in place that make housing very risky and very unattractive from a financial point of view. And people are responding to that. People are not stupid. They realize that they face this huge risk from the government, not only of the things it has done, but also what kind of other ideas they will come up with that will undermine your ability to, you know, to live and get some returns from your home. So I think to me, that's the primary goal. Now, the fact of the matter is many other Canadian markets like Toronto, and even Calgary now are experiencing similar declines. I think not quite as fast relative to trend, but there are other Canadian markets that are in trouble. And I think for that, there is a macroeconomic reason. For a decade, we basically had free money. Mortgage rates were about the same as inflation, you know, within 1%. And we kind of got used to that. When inflation and mortgage rates are about the same, the property price appreciation is making your mortgage payments. I realize month to month you have to write a check, but in the long run, whatever money you put towards your mortgage, you get back in price appreciation. So that's how inflation and interest rates work. This, of course, has changed. Now, the spread between mortgage rates and inflation is 2%, and this is down from like 3 or 4%. So it's actually very expensive to borrow. You know, some people argue 2% is not that much, but it is expensive relative to what we're used to. And that gives people a pause. You know, I think people realize that now mortgage rates are quite a bit higher than inflation. So they probably prefer to wait. Now, of course, you can, life goes on. Families grow and shrink and change and everything. So at some point, you can only delay that decision for so long. And I think we're seeing that many people are kind of deciding to enter the market because they can't delay anymore. And so that's why I think the volume in the last, you know, month and really very recently has been going up, especially in Vancouver. And I think it's now approaching the 10-year average or getting close to it. Still below, but getting close to it. And then the only other point is right now there's really pretty good inventory. So if you're looking for something that's slightly unusual, you can probably find some pretty amazing places. They're not exactly cheap, but more reasonably priced than usual. So when that happens, of course, people are going to enter that and buy those units, kind of regardless of the interest rate and inflation relationship, because it's a unit you're going to stay in for a long, long, long time. And then if you're able to do that, well, even if you kind of have to pay a little bit more in borrowing costs, as long as you can afford it, that's not the end of the world.
What about the argument about the uncertainty index and this idea that there's a lot of uncertainty in the market? And really, it kind of started, I guess, in February around Trump tariffs and that sort of thing. That seems to be a kind of a pervasive narrative, at least in the market, that there's a lot of uncertainty. Do you believe that as well, or is that not a driving factor?
Well, it's for sure a factor. I don't think it's a driving factor because the Canadian economy has been in decline for, well, since 2022. So since 2022, Canadian GDP per capita has been declining. It kind of went up in the first quarter of 2025 and then it was down. So it's by exactly the same amount. So it's flat for 2025, but it was declining before. So we're in full-blown recession, I think. I continue to be surprised how major media outlets are not describing our current economic state as a full-blown recession. We've been in a recession since 2022. And that, of course, the reason I bring that up is that, of course, was in place well before the tariffs. So the damage we have done to our economy with our own policies and excessive regulation and very, very high taxes, that was in place before. And yeah, tariffs have made it worse, but we have made ourselves incredibly vulnerable to tariffs and to any external factor because we've made it so difficult to really do any business in Canada.
This podcast is sponsored by Jethro Condos in downtown Langley. Over 100 homes under $425,000 with one-bedroom suites starting at $399,900.
Here's what's incredible, Adam. These condos actually cash flow. When's the last time we could say that about new construction in the Lower Mainland? With these entry-level prices, the numbers actually work for investors.
And you're in the heart of downtown Langley, surrounded by trendy cafes, artisan bakeries, and parks. The area is experiencing incredible growth and new development.
Yeah, the location is absolutely key. Jethro is steps from the future Langley SkyTrain station. Get in before that transit connection transforms the area. Because once that SkyTrain arrives, you're looking at direct connections across the Lower Mainland.
Jethro is a Whitetail Homes project. Whitetail Homes has over 25 years of experience with quality construction and finishes that exceed expectations. We're talking vibrant interiors, expansive windows, and thoughtful design.
For realtors listening, they are offering amazing cooperative incentives. This is a rare opportunity where the fundamentals make sense. Affordable entry, cash flow potential, and positioned for major transit infrastructure in all around win.
Register at jethrocondos.ca. That's J-E-T-H-R-O condos.ca.
Jethro Condos, distinctly Langley, uniquely yours. Andre, Mark Carney has a PhD in economics, as I understand.
Yeah.
He just came out with the budget that I guess is, we'll see if it passes. What's your take on kind of a more technocratic or data-driven approach to Canada? What do you think so far? Do you like him? Do you like what he's doing? Do you think we'll pull out of this with Carney's approach?
Well, you know, it's funny you take technocratic approach. I don't see that at all. I think obviously Mike Carney has a very impressive resume, much more impressive than mine. So if I understand this, certainly he understands this. And you cannot have a 54% marginal tax rate and ask for innovation in green energy or any field. Right? Those two things are entirely at odds, because innovation requires a lot of investment of time and money over a long period of time. And that you have to do, the inventor or, you know, the small business needs to do that kind of like at the cost of great sacrifice. So you're not making any money, you're working very hard in the hopes of some inventing something and then developing a product or a service that people want. And most of the time that fails, right? We understand that. And now and again, one thing works out. And then hopefully that will pay for all that previous time and effort and everything. And then the government says and comes and says, we'll take more than half, we'll take 54% of that. So no one would ever do it, right? And we don't have hardly any innovation in Canada. People put the effort here, but if something ever gets to be promising and successful, their first priority would be to move out, because otherwise, you know, 54%. So, and I'm sure Mike Carney and, you know, really any economist understand that. You cannot ask for innovation and have a 54% marginal tax rate. This is just impossible. You're telling people, don't innovate, don't do anything special. Get a steady job that pays whatever it pays, but doesn't change from year to year, because if it changes, when it's high, you get dinged. When it's low, you suffer the consequences. When your pay is high, you pay most of it to the government. So really the incentive of our tax system is to have a steady job that's not very hard and it gives you a steady paycheck and you kind of don't really care if the business does well or not. Because even if it does well and even if you get a big bonus, you know, you don't keep very much of that bonus. So I'm just giving that as an example, but this is, Our economic policy is riddled with contradictions like this. We say we want innovation. We say we want economic growth and certainly employment and all kinds of wonderful things. So we say the right words, but our economic policies are basically saying, whatever you do, don't do any of that. Because if you do, we'll penalize you so hard, you wish you never started it.
So what's the quick solution to fix that in your mind?
Well, so Canada has the most resources of any country in the world per capita. And we have a highly educated workforce, institutions that somewhat work, you know, less and less so, but still relatively well to the institutions in many other countries. So we have all the ingredients to be absolutely the richest country in the world. So we must have the highest income per capita of any country in the world. There's no country better positioned than Canada to achieve that. And yet, I recently looked it up, we are 22nd in the world. So for no reason at all, other than our highly misguided economic policy that basically discourages effort, discourages investment, and tells people, if you want to work hard and get a better life for yourself and your family, you've got to kind of go out somewhere else, because that's not going to happen here. So then your question was, how do we fix that? Well, it's pretty easy. Canada was at least following the trend in, you know, an economic growth per capita before 2018. So when the current Liberal government and, the Trudeau, the prime minister, came in, they started with the small business tax changes, and they didn't stop for about 6 years. So step one is reverse all of that, all of those measures that really made it much harder to do anything in Canada. Then we need to make it easy and safe to invest and to make things in Canada. And if anyone says, oh, but we have high labor costs, that's not an issue, right? There are many countries with very high labor costs that are still able to manufacture things and to provide services that everyone around the world wants. So it's good to have high labor costs. We want to have even higher labor costs. We want to have the higher labor costs in the world. Even so, I think we have all the ingredients to be an economic force like no one other around the world. And the only thing that stops us from doing that is our very misguided economic policies.
Andre, you've been critical of the government housing policies in BC. If you could rewrite one provincial housing policy from scratch, what would it be and why?
So you're asking me which one is the most detrimental. It's a long list, right? So we have the speculation and vacancy tax, the additional school tax, the Airbnb ban, that beneficial ownership registry. You know, I mean, it's really countless. The waiting period for real estate transactions, like speaking about, you know, nonsensical measures. It's a long, long list. So basically take the housing policies that we've put in place for the past, I don't know, 7 years, 8 years, and take your pick. They're pretty much all really, really detrimental. The one thing I do like is that is the upzoning and densification, because we do need to build more. But even that, you know, when done from a top-down approach like it was, it doesn't work, and it hasn't worked. So anyway, which one is the most detrimental? You know, I think the first one, the going back to the very first one, the speculation vacancy tax, is probably the one that's particularly hurtful. Not because, I mean, it has a big impact, but it's not that the impact is so big. It's just that that kind of policy sets the stage that we don't care about property rights. We do not. We have no problem telling people what they can and they cannot do with their own property. And by the way, we're going to act as if, you know, we, the government owns the property, not you. You make the payments and you maintain it and you sweat for it, but who'll tell you what to do with it? So that kind of thinking started with the speculation of vacancy tax and hasn't stopped. So I think we need to reverse all of them. But if we're going to start, well, maybe start with that one.
Andre, you know, I'm just thinking about what you said about how government policy has destroyed value, the value of real estate, or destroyed some of the value in Vancouver real estate. And then we're talking about other markets where there's kind of macro forces. And clearly these macro forces and other things going on in the economy and the world are impacting real estate as well. But I guess if policy is kind of the crucial factor, a change in policy is what is required to kind of get our real estate market kind of back in, you know, being more robust, I guess, than it is today. Would that be your take? Is that what it's going to take? Maybe I'll put it that way. Is that what it's going to take to get our real estate market back to kind of, you know, much higher sales volume, kind of a robust market that's kind of feels like it's not in recession?
Yeah, I think that's what will do it, especially in terms of actually housing more people, which I think is the ultimate goal here. Now, in terms of prices, yeah, you do kind of bring up a good point. If interest rates fall far enough and then kind of become the same as inflation or close to it, there will be a wave of people who are entering the market, and they'll say, you know, they'll take the risk because the financing terms are so advantageous. I'm basically borrowing for free, inflation is making my payments in the long run. So, you know, sure, I get all these risks and I hate it, but if I can finance it for free, why not? Why not roll the dice and to see what happens. So there are conditions at the national scale, mostly interest rates and inflation, that will get a lot of people back in the market, even if we don't have a change in policy. But that's not a sustainable way to run a market or run a country. because it creates its own issues down the line. And in particular, it creates the risk of a substantial price decline later on. So the only sustainable way to get back to, you know, a functioning market, and I'm very careful here, I want to say get back, because I don't think BC had a very functional market for a long time or really ever. But to get to a normal market where there is enough supply and transactions happen on a, you know, in a normal way, with no bidding wars and none of that, and we actually house a lot more people. To get to that goal, I think we need an entire reversal of the current policies, yes.
Just as a follow-up, Andre, do we need prices to be rising to house more people?
Well, it's either that or we need to make construction cheaper and mostly safer. So we need to make investment easier, cheaper, and safer. So if we drop all the countless requirements that we have imposed on investors in housing, like the beneficial ownership registry and you know other really nonsense like that, if we drop all of this, then we would reduce the risk of housing investment and we can get more housing investment that way, even if prices are stable. So we don't necessarily need rising prices to get sufficient investment. But when we constantly, through government policy, increase the risk of housing investment, that means we're increasing the required rate of return on that investment. And then to meet that very high and increasing rate of return on that investment, you do need rising prices.
Just thinking about building purpose-built rental as well, because you kind of had suggested earlier that it's a positive, but your concern is that a lot of it outside of the most recent push will not be built until we see, I guess, more demand in the rental market or easing off of the price of construction. Thinking about New York obviously just voted in large part for rent controls. And we've kind of seen a broader trend, I think, in a lot of kind of cosmopolitan cities. And Vancouver's Tenancy Act has tightened over the last few years and made it a lot more challenging for landlords and investors. Can you talk about rent control and if you see this as a positive or a negative or how it impacts the market, the rental market?
Yeah, so that's one example where economists almost never agree, right? Economists pretty much always disagree on everything, and that kind of is part of the fun. One area where economists, I think, agree on is rent control. So it's absolutely negative force in the rental market, and that's been around for a while. But there is a recent study that used the rent control change of policy in San Francisco. And that study published in the American Economic Review, you know, that's kind of like the top economics journal, where I haven't published in case you were wondering, but you know, that's aside. So that study very clearly shows that rent control has the opposite effect. It actually hurts the very people you're trying to help. And the mechanism is really pretty simple. You reduce supply. You shift supply away from the regulated market. And the regulated market can be in the same city or can be elsewhere. It doesn't matter. The moment you introduce rent control, investors are gonna just put their money somewhere else. And then, so this of course hurts supply. And the moment you hurt supply, you hurt renters. So if someone is in a place that they're going to live in for 20 years and not move, sure, great. They've benefited from rent control. They've won the lottery. They're going to have very long rent for a long time. But how many people are in that situation? For most people, you know, jobs change, families change. They need to move, even within the same city sometimes, you know, different cities in different countries. The moment you have to move, then you find out how devastating rent control is because you can't move, you can't find a new place. And even if you do, your rent is going to be astronomically high. So you end up not moving and not taking advantage of opportunities that present to you, that present themselves to you because of the rental market. So it's a terrible outcome. It really affects the people it's supposed to help. So fast forward to today, obviously we had rent control for a long time in BC. And we've seen the outcome. The outcome has been 1% vacancy rate for a decade. So I don't understand how someone doesn't look at that and say, well, maybe we need to think about doing this a different way. And again, we talked about the recent increase in rentals, but I think that's very temporary. I think that's people redirecting projects and ideas to what is the lesser evil. This will end, and then we're not going to get any more. So it's a devastating policy. We really need to get rid of it. Now, the issue is that if we get rid of it now, then rents are going to go up a lot because there's, even with the recent supply, there's still a shortage. So it needs to be done probably in a gradual way. Maybe start saying no rent control for new rental buildings ever, or something like that, where we gradually phase out rent control and we control rents through supply. So Seattle is the prime example. No rent control, none of that regulation. And in Seattle, you can find a place. In fact, I was looking not long ago at some ads, and they say if you move in, we'll give you $2,000, you know, Amazon gift card to furnish your place, or we'll give you 1 month rent free, or, you know, there is vacancy. Rents are not cheap, but there is vacancy. It's a normal functioning market with no rent control and no excessive regulation. So that's the goal. That's where we need to get to. But getting there after years of rent control cannot be immediate, right? That needs to be done gradually over 3 or 4 years.
Andre, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, but a lot of people talking about the Cowichan decision in Richmond, a little bit outside your field potentially, or maybe right in your wheelhouse. Thoughts on the impact of the Cowichan decision and just your general hot take?
Well, so I understand it's still under appeal, and so we don't know what's going to happen. But I think that's a terrible idea. This is awful. Every country that has expropriated private property like this has ended up with not just economic decline, has ended up with starvation and like real, real third world type outcomes. And this has happened every single time. So, you know, we've talked before on the show. I come from Bulgaria, maybe you remember. So I'm very aware how things evolved in Eastern Europe, where, you know, the Russian and communism came and took over Eastern Europe, and property was expropriated. And we've seen the outcome of that. But it's not just Eastern Europe, right? It's every other country that has undermined property rights and has expropriated private property has ended with absolutely nothing, like not just 5% or 10% economic decline. We're talking famine and shortages of essentials. And there is a very clear mechanism for that. Unless you have private property protection, no one has any incentive to invest. So we're basically down to subsistence farming then if we can't protect property rights. So that's you know, my concern. Hopefully we're not going to go down that road because obviously British Columbia and Canada are great places and there's plenty of resources to go around for everyone. But if this ends up taking away private property, that, you know, that's going to put our way of life really at risk. And then the other point is kind of outside of real estate. But I'm really concerned that's going to also undermine the progress we've made on reconciliation and building relationships with the First Nations. I think this is a terrible outcome for First Nations as well, because it takes time to build support and recognition in the general society. And I think they have done that very successfully. And I see what we've done at SFU and how great things are in terms of relations with First Nations and First Nations students and all of that. And I am worried that the moment you take people's homes away, all that progress that took years to achieve is going to go right back to zero. and it's going to put us at odds with each other. So it's a hugely critical decision. Hopefully, wiser heads will prevail and kind of see the big picture here. Otherwise, this has the potential to be really devastating for us.
Andre, just curious about your thoughts where we're at. You know, it feels like 5 years ago, everybody was talking about investing in real estate. And now everybody's talking about investing in AI and even the S&P 500. You know, everybody's all in. And it feels like that market's a little shaky. At least the headlines every day seem to suggest as much. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the AI boom, if you've been following along. Is real estate dead? Is this just part of a normal ebb and flow where people will be back? What's your take on the bubble, if it exists, and where we're at in this kind of back and forth between real estate and the stock market?
So wait a minute. I thought AI is supposed to make our lives better and work instead of we do. So then if that's the plan, we're going to need more real estate, right? We want to have bigger places to live and not nicer places, right? So if anything, it's going to help real estate, no?
It all goes together. Yeah.
It all goes together, yes. Because AI is now going to do all the work. We're going to be spending more time at home, so we need nicer homes, right? I thought it's supposed to help anything. Anyway, but more seriously, going back to the bubble question, who knows? It's clearly a new technology. It's wonderful. I use it. You know, my kids use it. It's not perfect. Is it possible that investment and valuations got ahead of themselves? Absolutely. I mean, that's kind of like what everyone is saying right now. But if you look at the graph for AI stocks, if you look at them over 3 days, you're saying AI is over, right? It's done. It was a mistake. You shouldn't look at these things over 3 days. You should look at them over, you know, a year or two or three. And if you do that, you're not going to even see the recent decline, which is, you know, not tiny, but you're not even going to see it. So my point is, we can't really look at what's happening in the past day or two or three, especially in technology that is so new. And then the parallel is, imagine this is like the analogy for 2000, year 2000 for internet stocks. Imagine if that's the case and all those AI stocks are going to go down in half, like the internet stocks went down in half after 2000, right? So imagine this is the first step in that. And now imagine someone says, you know what, I'll let you go back to year 2000 at the very peak of the market and let you buy internet stocks. Would you do it? And the answer is hell yeah, absolutely, right? So my point is, obviously, I don't know what's going to happen, but look, it's a fantastic new technology. AI is not going to go away. It's only going to get better. And imagine you were just starting the 50% decline. So what? If you can wait 10 or 15 years, no problem. If you need the money in 2 years, you shouldn't be in stocks to begin with.
Sage advice.
Well, Andre, thanks so much for taking the time today. Really appreciate it. And how can people find out more about what you're up to?
Oh, they can look me up at SFU. I have a profile there where I kind of put recent articles and things. And then I'm on X. So Andrei Pavlov, it's not far hard to find me. So a lot of that is pure entertainment, but a bit of it is serious. So I post some thoughts and comments there as well. So those are the two main channels, I guess.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time. As always, Andre, I feel like there's a lot to unpack there, a lot to think about. So appreciate your time.
Of course. Thank you.
So there you have it, folks. Our discussion with SFU's Andre Pavlov, finance professor at the Beatty School of Business. Past guest fan favorite, of course. It's always great when Andre has the time to speak with us. I feel like I could talk to him every week.
Yeah, no kidding. And for a lot longer, like that hour flew by. We were being very conscious of his, he's a very busy person.
Didn't even get the five wire in this time.
I know. But you know, the other thing I should say is we've got, there's something about, before we talk about the shows coming up, because we've got a lot of exciting guests in the near future here. But there's something about really great professors when they can simplify complicated things. I feel like a lot of what we sometimes do on this show is complicate simple things. And he's really good at simplifying complicated things. And in a way that it's like, he just cuts right down to the, you know, it's like, no, this is why this is. And it's very simple. Like his concept about devaluing, like you've basically taken a bedroom away from a home in terms of value or whatever it is. Your use of what you can do with the property goes down. Therefore, it's worth less.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like that's just how it goes. And that was policy created. So lots of like just really simple.
And the interesting thing, you never really think about how government policy literally impacts like that concrete, like the, I think you're right. The way he said, okay, like that's like closing off a bedroom in your house.
Well, when you remove what you can do with a property, it decreases the value. And I mean, so there's a lot of interesting takeaways like that. You know, it's refreshing to get away from the tariff narrative as well. When you think about it, Matt, it's actually kind of overwhelmed the conversation. Like everyone's gone or it's distracted from what's happening locally, I think, where you can just say, oh, it's tariff related. Oh, it's Trump down south.
Yeah, we didn't get into it with Andre, but can you imagine how frustrated he would have been listening to the provincial government blame everything on the states?
Yeah.
And you know what? I'm all for it, right? Elbows up, Adam. But at the same time, distraction is a hell of a political tool.
Yes, for sure, Matt. What else do we have before we cut for the day?
What else do we have? Well, we usually talk about VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, Adam, and the buyer's tools we have over there. You just hit buy with us for private client services. We have the sold plan, click sell with us. But really what I'd like to say, Adam, is I feel like we really have great guests that are providing a lot of value recently, and I hope others feel the same. If you like the show, please rate, review, or share with a friend. I feel like sharing with a friend is a very useful way to get people aware of the show. And a lot of people are not that interested in real estate right now. I think we're still adding a lot of value here. So if you like what you're hearing, please share or rate the show. And that's all we can ask.
Yeah. And our Cowichan episode, the Cowichan decision with Sam Atkins, a local lawyer, has almost 300 comments, Matt, over on YouTube right now. Lots of people engaging in meaningful and less meaningful dialogue around the Cowichan decision. So lots of if you do want to comment on the show, feel free to leave a remark in Spotify or on YouTube or wherever you're listening to the program. And Matt, how can people get in touch?
You can try me at 778-847-2854. I don't want to hear a lot of those comments in person, but or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or if you know who hit my car, it's 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we have that nonpartisan line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Have a great week and we'll see you next week with another great episode, including, I think we got Adam Bowden-Ball on next week to talk about how to set up for retirement, how to tie in real estate, strategies around buying real estate for first-time home buyers, strategies for people that are kind of nearing retirement age or want to retire early. So many takeaways from this conversation. I'm fired up. So come back next week for another great episode.
Take care.
2,000 Spaces for Radio. Subscribe today.